Grace, mercy, and peace be yours from the triune God. Amen. From the book of Job. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and that at last he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been thus destroyed, then in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see on my side, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. This is the claim that Job, in his despairing, has a proclamation of life after this life, a proclamation of the afterlife. You probably know the music by Handel, I Know That My Redeemer Liveth, based on this passage. It was a bit of music my organist used to play a couple of parishes back, and we used to try and time the coffin and me saying those words of Job and the music itself all together as we came into the church. Job's suffering is existential. He's lost everything. He's lost his oxen and donkeys, his sheep, his camels, his sons and daughters, and now he's covered in sores. He's criticized by his wife, and then three comforters turn up and accuse him of wrongdoing. The basis of the comforters' argument is Job must have done something wrong, because otherwise, why is he suffering? But did Job really have a belief in the afterlife? Another point in the book of Job, he says this, as a cloud fades away, so whoever goes down to Sheol does not come up. Job's experience of desolation leads to both a belief and a disbelief in God, both a belief and a disbelief in God's providential care for those beyond this life. But what of us on this Remembrance Sunday? Do we believe that this world is all there is, or do we believe that life continues? That in some way we meet those who we loved but see no longer? I'm not going to give a straight answer to that question, but what I'm going to suggest is that when we ask the question about life beyond this life, that question in turn ends up questioning us. Something along the lines of, how do we live with uncertainty? How do we live with that existential uncertainty? So let me suggest a way that the question we ask ends up in turn questioning ourselves. We often think of language in this way, post-Enlightenment anyway, that a subject, something that is done, a subject is doing something, a verb is what is done, and it's done to an object. Language, if you like, is linear. Subject, verb, object. I, subject, read, verb, the book of Job, object. I read the book of Job. An example of this is a priest colleague of mine, after the Twin Towers in 2001, received from the authorities in New York some rubble. He was given rubble because he lost his daughter in the Twin Towers, and nothing was ever found of her. So he was given something that, in a tangible sense, gave an understanding of his daughter. So, priest, or father in this case, subject, gazes upon verb, rubble, object. Priest gazes upon rubble. Nice, clear, objective language, but that is not what really happens. Language is not linear in that sense in reality. Rubble, subject, questions, verb, priest, object. There is a circle. What he gazes upon, in turn, gazes upon himself. Another example, I was in the town of Merville at the start of this week in northern France. The Western Front ran close to that town for the entire length of the First World War. So I ended up gazing upon thousands of headstones, literally thousands. I, subject, gaze, verb, upon headstones, object. But of course, in turn, those headstones question me. And there are a couple of headstones that really brought it home to me. They were from the Army Cyclist Corps. The Army Cyclist Corps, subject, challenges me, verb, me, object. Challenges, verb, me, object. I am challenged by looking upon those headstones. To misquote a realization, a sort of proverb, I realized that I am cycling on the shoulders of giants. I read the book of Job. I subject, read, verb, book of Job, object. In turn, Job's wrestling and questioning reads me. How do I live with existential uncertainty? Both, if you like, the denial and the affirmation in Job's book of the afterlife. How do I live in the face of unjust suffering? Job is suffering and there's no reason for it. And indeed, Remembrance Sunday, we remember the sacrifice. The sacrifice challenges me, challenges us. We today should leave changed by coming to this church. How? How are we, if you like, read by that experience of Remembrance Sunday? We should be challenged for a renewed commitment to peace, an enhanced compassion for those who suffer. And when you consider the sort of political machinations around the roots of the Great War, we should have a drive to avoid escalating conflict. The great World War I poet Wilfred Owen wrote the parable of the old man and the young. And his whole point about this poem was this futile inability for the old man to learn either from his biblical tradition, the biblical tradition where Abraham went to offer his son Isaac, saw the ram caught by the ram's horns and slaughtered the ram instead, not his own son. So the old man couldn't learn neither from his biblical tradition nor actually from the experience that was going on around him, the experience of the First World War. The old man just had that straight line view of language. He didn't see that language and thought is circular. He did not allow himself to be read either by the Bible or by the circumstances. And so Wilfred Owen writes this: "Behold, a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. Offer the ram of pride instead." But the old man would not do so, but slew his son and half the seed of Europe, one by one. To draw things together, the afterlife and divine justice can feel like abstract concepts, things we are unable to prove. They're not objective facts in a world which values the objective. But can we live as though they are true? As if these abstract concepts of the afterlife and of divine justice are gazing upon us? What would that mean if we lived as if every life was eternally valuable? What would it mean if the source of all requires justice? And if we ask these questions, it should not be what happens when we die that we want to find out, but how should we live? My organist, the one that used to play "I Know That My Redeemer Liveth" as I came into the church with the coffin, he died. And another organist had to work out how to choreograph my old organist service. And one day, of course, someone will be choreographing my service. Can I live as if one day I will meet my organist again? And if I can, how does that influence and challenge my pastoral care around funerals? How does that influence and challenge my appreciation of the beauty of music? And this is a question for all of you. How do the dead continue to read us?